being held back? Asked my mother. Hearing this, my father winked at me. I guess that he thought that this was a good question, and he was proud of my mother for having asked it.
No, said my teacher. The other boy, whom I was also going to recommend to be held back, he and his family have moved from the area.
I didn't want to, but I couldn't help myself, and I began to cry. Then I was going to be the only stupid, slow learner to be held back in all of my class. I'd so much hoped to spare my parents the terrible shame of finding out that their son was stupid. My brother Joseph and sister Tencha had never flunked. I wish I could die, I felt so bad. Seeing the tears running down my face, my father put his huge, thick hand on my shoulder, stroking me gently. Tell me, he said to my teacher, just how much do you want?
How much what? Asked my teacher.
Money, said my dad, reaching for his pocket. We can settle this thing right now.
Salvador, said my mother, please, none of that.
Y por qué no? He said, getting out of the little desk and bringing out the huge roll of money that he always kept in the right front pocket of his slacks or Levi's. Only fools carried their money in wallets in their back pockets, our father always told us. Money talks. Hocus-pocus bullshit just stinks.
Excuse me, said my teacher, but this isn't about money. This is about your son's future. If he doesn't get his foundation of reading down, he'll have trouble all of his life.
Good, said my father. All life is trouble, so why the hell worry, eh?
Excuse me, but you don't seem to understand.
I don't understand, roared my father, putting his money back in his pocket. Hell, I've forgotten more than you or most people will ever understand.
Salvador, said my mother as quietly as she could, why don't you and Mundo go outside and let me talk to this woman alone?
Damn good idea, said my father. Let's go outside, mijo, and get us some fresh air. It stinks de puro pedo here. Listen to me good, said my father the moment we were out the door. He was hot, I could tell. Everybody has their own game, understand? Lawyers got theirs, doctors got theirs, business people got theirs. Every bum on the street has his, too. Got it? And every game has two sets of rules. The one set that they tell people that they play by, but listen closely. Behind their closed doors, these same people always got another set of rules that they really play their game with. The church, she does this beautifully, having people pray to Cristo, oh, so sweetly. Then they get all those young nuns and priests to work for free for them all their lives. And yet from behind those closed doors, that good-hearted, all-loving church steals the best lands of Mexico, and the whole world if she could. Education, mijo, is another racket, another con game. Don't let nobody fool you. School wants to get people thinking all the same way, like trained mice. Don't you ever fall for nobody's racket, mijito. Think here in your head, feel here in your heart, and trust your tanates here between your legs, a lo chingón. This is life in all her power and glory. Got it? He said, gently putting his huge, thick hand on my shoulder.
I got it, Papa, I said, wiping the tears out of my eyes. And I really did get it. I loved my father con todo mi corazón. He made so much sense, just like Ramon and even Gus. All these guys made sense, and they took no shit from nobody.
Good. Because knowing how to think and how to work is how you get ahead in life, not just education. Talone, that Italiano over from Temecula who buys our cattle from us, he says that he had to lose his leg before he finally learned how to think. Before that, he was always strong like a bull, trying to move the world with his muscles. But then he lost his right leg in a tractor accident. Couldn't be hired anymore, and he began to think. He bought a calf here, a goat there, butchered them, and sold the meat. Soon he was buying 2-3 head of cattle at a time.
and supplying the best restaurants in San Diego with steaks, and selling the rest of the meat out of his butcher shop at a good, fair price. He's a multimillionaire now. He has no school education, but he has life education that taught him to open his eyes, see, and think. You're doing good, mijito. You're a worker, and I've seen you think and figure things out. This woman teacher says that you'll have trouble in life. Well, I say good. Let trouble come, and you just kick trouble's ass a lo chingon, huh?
Suddenly, my whole heart felt full of power. My dad had turned the whole thing around. I didn't feel terrible or stupid anymore. I was able to stop crying. Some kids now came by on their bikes, and they saw my father with his big Western hat, fancy shirt and belt, and cowboy boots. "Do you really have a horse, mister?" asked one kid, dropping his right foot off the pedal of his bike to the ground.
"Hell yes," said my dad. "A whole string of them."
"A string of horses?"
"Yeah, you know, like when you string them up to a wagon."
"You mean you got a stagecoach like in the Wild West?"
"Yeah,"
said my dad. "A feed wagon." "Could we come over and ride your horses?" asked the other kid.
"Yeah, sure," said my dad, glancing at me. "If it's all right with my son."
I was so glad that my dad had thought of including me, because these two guys weren't really my friends, so I didn't want them coming out to our ranch. But before I could say anything, my mother came out of the classroom. She looked pensive, and all the way back to our Rancho Grande we drove in silence. At home, my mother explained to me that I was going to have to repeat the third grade. And how my classmates found out about this, I'll never know. But for the last 2 weeks of school, they made fun of me, calling me a retard, a flunker, and once more, school became a living nightmare. But this time, I didn't start wetting my bed again. No, my father's words had given me strength and confidence. And the two guys who'd asked if they could come horseback riding, I never invited them to our Rancho Grande, but I did invite Gus. And Gus, I found out, really had flunked a grade in Texas. And so this was why he was bigger and stronger than the rest of us kids. He was a whole year older than the rest of us. It turned out that Gus also knew a lot about horses. He was able to saddle his own horse, and he was a pretty damn, I mean, blessed good rider, too. We ended up playing cowboys and Indians on horseback, running through different orchards. I was the Indian, he was the cowboy. And one day, I tried jumping off my horse to a tree branch at a full gallop so I could swing up into the tree as I'd seen done in a cowboy movie, in which the hero had swung up in the tree and then jumped out of the tree on the bad guy who was coming behind him. But I never made it. Hitting the branch, I got knocked backwards off my horse so hard that when I hit the ground, I saw stars. The next thing I knew, Gus was on the ground beside me, slapping me in the face and asking me if I was dead. And when I finally came to, he started laughing and laughing, saying that he'd never seen someone do such a crazy-ass stunt in all his life.
"But I saw the hero do it in a movie," I said.
"Yeah, but movies are fake. Didn't you know that? In the movies, I'm sure they don't really run their horses under those trees at a full gallop. They probably just trot their horses under, then the movie maker speeds up the film, you fool."
That was the day I realized that movies weren't really true. And yeah, sure, I'd always known that movies were pretend, but I'd also kind of thought that they were real in how they were made and that the movie stars were kind of, well, really like those people that they pretended to be. I'd almost had my head knocked off when I'd tried to do what I'd seen them do in the movies. I was never going to trust these damn, I mean, blessed movies again. One day, Gus and I were walking home. He had no bike, so I'd stopped riding mine so he wouldn't feel bad. And it started sprinkling, and all these snails came out on the road. I don't know why, but Gus and I began leaping on them with our boots and smashing them into the ground. Dozens of them, hundreds of them, squish, 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 popping their little shells. Just this side of California Street, we spotted a great big lizard and we caught him. It had stopped sprinkling, so we found some newspaper
set fire to the paper in the middle of the dirt road, and tossed the lizard into the flames. We watched the lizard trying his best to get out of the burning fire, but every time he'd almost make it out, we'd kick him back into the flames with our boots. Once, I'll never forget, the lizard opened his mouth, and I'd never heard a lizard scream before. It was awful. It almost sounded like a little human baby crying. That night it rained and stormed, and I was afraid to go to sleep, because every time I'd close my eyes, a great big lizard would come out of the storm to my window and open his mouth, screaming out in agony. I got up and ran out of my bedroom, yelling for my mother. Finding her, I told her that there was a huge lizard at my window. "Bigger than a horse," I shouted.
"Mijito," said my mother, "there are no such lizards. You're just having a bad dream."
My parents were having dinner with our good German friends, the Hulsters, and I was supposed to be asleep by now.
"No, Mama, I'm not dreaming," I said. "My eyes were wide open, and I could see the lizard. Come, I'll show him to you. When he opens his mouth, it's as big as lifting the hood of our new car."
Hans and Helen Hulster laughed. They were my little sister Linda's godparents, and they lived out at Bonzel, where they had a huge chicken ranch, and they'd come into town to see us.
"Excuse me," said my mother to Hans and Helen. "I'll be right back."
And she got up and took my hand and walked me down the long, dark hallway of our old ranch house to my bedroom. Ever since my brother Joseph wasn't feeling well, I'd been sleeping alone in a room in the back. None of us were allowed to disturb our brother Joseph, who needed all the rest he could get. But when my mother and I went into my bedroom, the huge lizard was gone. He wasn't outside of my window anymore. Now all I could see outside of my window was the storm and lightning and the hanging branches of our old huge persimmon tree that was dancing in the wind to beat hell.
"But he was right there, Mama, I swear it, right there in front of those branches."
"It was just your imagination, Mijito," said my mother.
"No, Mama," I yelled. "I really, really saw him, and he was huge, and he opened his mouth so big that I thought he was going to come in and eat me and the whole house."
"Get under the covers, Mijito," she said, "and I'll sing you to sleep." Hearing my mother say this, I instantly felt all better and quickly got under my covers. Mi mama began to sing to me cuckoo-roo-cuckoo as she gently soothed my forehead and tummy. Everything began to feel warm and good and safe and wonderful. Soon I must have fallen asleep, because no sooner had my mother left, and here was that huge monster at my window once again. But this time he was a frog, a great, big, huge frog. And when he opened his mouth, croaking real loud, his long tongue came out, throwing up dead snails and burnt lizards all over me on my bed. I screamed, leaped out of my bed, and went racing out of my room, down the hallway, and to the dining room table, where my parents were now having after-dinner drinks and coffee with Hans and Helen Hulster.
"Mama," I screamed, "he's a frog now, and he threw up dead snails and lizards all over me."
My mother glanced at Hans and Helen. She looked kind of embarrassed.
"Mijito," she said, "there are no giant frogs or lizards. It's all just your imagination."
"No, Lupe," said my father. "The boy is right. I've seen these monster frogs and lizards too. Even ants once, as big as trucks." "Come here, Mijito," he said. "Tell me," he added, holding me at arm's length by my shoulders as he looked into my eyes, "man to man, what terrible thing did you do to some snails and frogs today?"
I almost shit in my pajama bottoms. How did my dad know this? And if he did he really expect me to tell him in front of everyone what it was that Gus and I had done? We'd been awful. And that poor lizard, I could still see his mouth wide open as he screamed for help.
"Come on, Mijito. I've told you 1,000 times that to the cop or the priest we might need to lie, but to ourselves or La Familia, we never lie. What did you do? Did the snails come out by the hundreds this afternoon in the rain, and you went around killing them?"
I had to hold myself with both hands between the legs real tight so I wouldn't pee. My God, how did my dad know this?
Yes, Papa,
I finally said.
We did.
Hans laughed, saying, good riddance, damn snails, they get into everything. But on our place, the chickens clean them out. And that's the way it should be, Hans, said my father to the big German. Nothing wasted, just a normal part of life. Chickens eating snails, but here, we have a whole different situation. These boys were killing just for fun. Hans laughed. I could see that he was feeling nervous.
Sal, he's just a boy, said Hans. And boys will be boys, you know that.
No, Hans, boys do not have to just be boys. That's why my mother raised me up like a woman for the first 7 years of my life, so that I, a male, would then have respect for all life just like women, who know that all life is sacred. Tell me, mijito, said my father, turning back to me. And the frog? What did you boys do to a frog?
Nothing to a frog, Papa, I said, beginning to cry. It was a lizard that we caught and we burned him.
Alive? Asked my dad.
Yes,
I had to say.
My father nodded and then nodded again. And when he reached out for me, I ducked, thinking that he was going to hit me. But he didn't. Instead, he took me into his arms and held me close. I could feel his whole chest expand and contract against me as he breathed.
Well then, you got good reason to be seeing all these monster lizards and frogs and snails, don't you? He said.
I nodded.
So now you got to go to your room, mijito, and kneel down and pray and ask Papito Dios to forgive you. Because, remember, as I've taught you and your brother here on the ranch, we never take any life without showing respect. And above all else, we never torture or have fun in the act of killing. Got it? We know what we do, and we do it quick and gently and always for a good reason. To kill even a snail just for fun is not being respectful
of God, who is in all things. I said, as I'd been told all of my life for as long as I could remember.
Exactly, said my father.
So now go and pray, and ask Papito to forgive you for having offended him.
I nodded, and I glanced around. Everyone was looking at me.
But I'm scared, I said. Will you go with me to pray, Papa?
No, this you must do alone, mijito, he said.
But he says that he's scared, said my mother, and he's just a little boy, Salvador.
How old are you? Asked my dad.
8, I said.
You see, Lupe, he's not a little boy. He's 8 years old, 1 year past being 7 years old, and at 8 is when we stop raising a boy as a girl and we step him through that needle's eye into manhood. He was big enough to kill and torture without mercy, Lupe, and so now he needs to earn his tanates, because tanates without respect are very, very dangerous. And also, you tell me, Lupe, what's wrong with him being scared? The deer lives her whole life in fear of the lion, but still she has her babies and a good life. Fear is good, Lupe. It helped you and me be strong in the revolution. And now, in peacetime, fear is the only thing that helps keep us, people, honest, especially men. Now go on alone, mijito, and you ask Papito Dios to help you make peace with these monster snails and frogs. Then they'll leave you alone.
Still, I didn't want to go alone. No, I wanted to leap into my mother's arms and have her hold me forever and ever. But I could also see that my dad was right, and I needed to walk down that long dark hallway to my room by myself. I hugged and kissed my father that night as I'd never hugged and kissed him before. Then I hugged my mother real tight, kissing her too. Then I said, Gute Nacht, in German to Hans and Helen, hugged them also. Then I turned and started down the long hallway,
feeling more scared than I'd ever felt in all my life.
But I could really see that what my father had said to me made a whole lot of sense, and in doing this alone, by myself, I was on my way to becoming un hombre a las todas, a man for all seasons, which meant, literally, as my dad had explained to my brother and me many times, a man whose balls had dropped so he could then reproduce in any kind of weather, hot or cold, all year long. Because males whose balls hadn't dropped could then only reproduce during a few days in the spring of each year. And fear was the main reason why most men's balls remained hidden up in their body. I could now see very clearly that Ramon, even though he'd just been a little kid, had already been un hombre de las todas with dropped balls in kindergarten. And my father, he'd been forced to become this type of man at 10 years old in the Mexican Revolution. Suddenly I realized that Jesus Christ must have had really big dropped balls, or he would have screamed out in fear when they drove those nails into him. Yeah, sure, this made sense. He would have never been able to say, "Forgive them, for they do not know what they do," if he hadn't had dropped tanates, and big ones, too. Thinking this, I felt a whole lot better as I walked down the long, dark hallway. Then I heard the floorboards of our old house screeching beside me as I went barefoot down the long hallway. I smiled. Jesus was here with me. I could feel him. I wasn't walking alone. Getting to my room, I immediately saw that there was no huge lizard or frog at my window. So I went inside, leaving the door open, and knelt down before my bed, and I began to pray, as I'd never prayed before in all my life. "Dear Papito Dios," I said, "please, I ask you with all my heart and soul to forgive me for having killed all those snails and that one lizard. I'll never do it again, I swear. So please, please, please forgive me. In fact, tomorrow, if it rains, I'll pick up snails all afternoon on Stewart Street and help them get across the road so that the cars don't run over them. Please, dear Lord God, I just didn't know what I was doing." After saying this, that I just didn't know what I was doing, a bad feeling raced up and down my spine. Then this meant that I was exactly like one of those guys who'd driven the nails into Jesus' hands. I started crying. "Please, Lord God," I yelled, "forgive me, forgive Gus and me, because I now see that both of us really didn't know what we were doing, or we would have never, never done it. Please forgive us, and I'll tell Gus too, no more stomping snails with our cowboy boots, ever." It was at this moment, as I said all this, that I heard a huge croak, and I turned and saw that huge frog outside of my window again. But this time he wasn't scary anymore. No, now his eyes were smiling, and he looked so kind. "I forgive you," said the frog. "You forgive me?" I said. "But I was talking to God." "Yes, I know," said Frog. At that very instant, I finally understood everything that mi mamá grande had been telling me ever since I was little and we'd lived in the barrio de Carlos Malo, meaning Carlsbad, and she'd taken me hand in hand all through her garden, because I could now see so clearly that this frog was the animal spirit that had been given to me at birth. And the animal spirit that was assigned to a person when they came into this world was, indeed, the window through which they could see God. And those snails that Gus and I had killed were God, too. This, my animal spirit, Frog, was now telling me. All of life was holy, 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 and sacred. This was why my brother Joseph had explained to me that our mama grande, Doña Margarita, had never allowed him and my sister Tencha to damn anything. To bless ourselves and everything was the only way to live. I now saw this so blessed clearly. "Good night, Frog," I said. "Good night, my child," said Frog.
That night in my dreams, I had wonderful travels. I drew a star in my sleep, colored it in, then jumped in the star, and I was off to heaven. I'd prayed, found my animal spirit, and so I was able to sleep beautifully all night long up in Papito Dios's holy arms. In the morning, I awoke feeling wonderful, meaning full of wonder. I was 8 years old, 1 year past seven, and I'd done as my father had told me to do. I'd gone down that long, dark hallway alone, shitting in my pants with fear. But then I'd felt Jesus at my side, and I'd prayed, asking for forgiveness, and I'd passed through the needle's eye into manhood. Chapter 10. Our huge house was done, finished, completed, and this afternoon mi papa and I were way out by the front gates of our Rancho Grande. He was letting me drive our big new tractor while he hooked up the chain to a tree stump that we'd dynamited so we could drag the stump away. Boy, oh boy, I now knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be a tractor-driving, dynamite-setting cowboy. Then I could just about outdo even Superman. "Put it in reverse," yelled my dad, "and come back real slow. That's it, real slow. I don't want you running my ass over." I did what he said real carefully, because I'd seen one of our workmen go to the hospital last week with a crushed leg because our main tractor driver hadn't been paying close attention. We were dragging stumps out of the way and getting the front grounds of our ranch ready for our big housewarming celebration. It was almost sundown when a man drove up in a beautiful, long, baby blue convertible. He wore a white Panama hat and looked like he'd just stepped out of a magazine. He was so clean. Even his shoes were spotless. He didn't have cow shit anywhere on him, and it wasn't even Sunday. "Excuse me," he said, getting out of his car and walking up to my father and me, who were covered with dirt and mud and probably some cow manure, too. "But isn't this the place where they're going to have a big celebration this weekend?"
"Y qué cabrones," said my dad,
wrapping the chain around the next stump that we needed to move. We were now working next to the little three-bedroom guest house that my parents had built near the front gates of our Rancho Grande so that we could stop people from coming all the way down our long driveway to our main house. My dad and I had been working outside for hours. My mother and brother and two sisters had gone down to San Diego to check on the last of our furniture that was being shipped in from Europe.
"Do you speak English?" asked the man.
He had on a short-sleeved shirt with colorful birds and flowers on it, and cream-white slacks and those blessed, clean, two-tone shoes.
"English," said my dad. "Yeah, sometimes. But then some other times, no damn way."
"Oh, I see," said the man, looking confused. "Well, I was wondering if this was where the mansion was built. But this house," he added, referring to the guest house, "doesn't look that big."
"Hell no, this is the guest house," shouted my father,
having wrapped and hooked the chain and signaled for me to now put it in low gear and go forward.
"The castle is that way, past all those eucalyptus and orchards."
"A castle, really?"
20 or 30 rooms, and each room big enough to hold a horse and buggy." "Yes, I'd heard that too," said the man with a big smile. "Do you work for him?"
yelled the man, wanting to be heard above the roar of the tractor as I now went forward.
"Who?" "The owner. I hear that he's not from these parts." "Hell no," yelled my father. "He's from Europe, I hear. And Mexico, too. He has castles, I hear, all over the world."
"Really?"
"Well, I don't know," said my dad,
signaling for me to cut the motor. I'd guessed that I'd pulled the stump far enough out of the way.
"I never seen them, but that's what I've heard."
"Then you do work for him?"
"Yeah, my son and me. But we've only seen him just a few times. You see, he comes, you know, at night, then he's gone. But we got to keep everything ready for him day or night in case he and his wife show up." "I hear tell that his wife is beautiful," said the man.
Hearing this, my dad turned and looked at the man, sizing him up. Myself, I could hardly keep from laughing. My dad turned and gave me a hard look. I stopped my smiles.
"Get this damn tractor to the barn," he barked at me. "That's it for the day.
Look, I'm sorry if I'm disturbing you, said the man. I don't want to get you and your son fired, he added.
You won't, said my dad. The owner, he's not here right now. Come on, I'll show you the place. And yes, I saw his wife once. Not from real close, but what I saw, I'd say that, yeah, she's more beautiful than any movie star you'll ever see, said my dad with pride.
Really? Said the man.
Yes. Now come on. You give me a ride in your car, and my son will take the tractor in for the day.
You trust a boy with that huge tractor?
Hell, I trust that boy with my life, yelled my father. He can outride, outthink most grown men. And next year he'll have his own gun, so that no son of a bitch man can walk on his shadow without permission.
A gun? But he's a child.
It's never too early for a boy or girl to learn about the ins and outs and responsibilities of life.
But with a gun?
Shit, yes, with a gun, said Dad,
opening the passenger door to his car. Suddenly I could see that the man wasn't too worried about guns anymore. Now he was all upset about my father getting into his nice, clean convertible. My dad saw it too, but he just winked at me and got in the man's car, then dusted all the dirt off himself. The man almost shit a brick. I had to work hard not to laugh.
Straight ahead, friend,
said my dad, acting like he hadn't noticed the man's reaction. Ford, John Ford, said the man.
Juan Puro Pedo,
said my dad, taking the man's clean hand in his dirty hand. They drove through our big white stucco gates, past the Spanish-style guest house and down the long line of towering eucalyptus trees, and past the orchards of avocados, lemons, and oranges. I put the tractor in third so I could go a little bit faster, and followed them down the long driveway, then took the right fork up towards the tractor barn and horse corrals. They took the left fork and drove up the newly blacktopped driveway to our new two-story home. For over a month, we'd been planning this great big housewarming celebration. We'd fattened a steer, two goats, three pigs, and there were a dozen women working on homemade tortillas, enchiladas, frijoles, arroz, salsa, potato salad, corn on the cob, string beans, and fresh apple cobbler a la capirotada with fresh honey. All of Carlsbad and Oceanside were invited. The celebration was to last 3 days. Mariachis were being brought in from San Diego and Tijuana. Tequila, beer, and wine were going to be served by the barrel. More than 500 people were expected. Cars and trucks and horse-drawn buggies were going to be parked in the orchards. For nearly a month, we'd all been working around the clock. And then last week, my mother had told my father that she wanted some white gates to be built at the front of our Rancho Grande to give the celebration an elegant entrance. And my father, he hadn't gotten angry with her request. No, he'd looked at our mother in silence. Then he'd turned to us kids.
Just look at this woman that I married, he'd said to us. She was born in a little ranchita in the mountains of Chihuahua, Mexico, and she grew up so poor that they had nothing but a shack anchored to a rock. And here she feels so natural giving orders to everyone, like she'd been a queen all of her life.
Don't ridicule me, Salvador, snapped our mother.
I'm not, querida, said our dad. I'm doing the opposite, because you just never fail to amaze me. I think I know you, then you become even greater than I dreamed. I give you honor, querida. You are la reina de mi corazón, the queen of my heart. So much blood and hunger we saw. And still you rise up with the vision of an angel. Hell yeah, we'll get those gates built, y pronto.
I'll never forget the old bricklayer that my dad brought in to do the job. His arms and hands were huge and hairy, and he wore his Levi's so low that you could see the crack of his ass. He always carried a pint bottle of whiskey in his back pocket and farted louder than a racehorse when he worked. He was the best and fastest bricklayer in all of Southern California. He was the one who'd done all the brickwork of the front and back patios of our new home. And now he went to work on those front gates like a stud horse going after a mare in heat.
Of course I'll get these damn big gates done in time for your celebration, he'd said to my dad. You're my kind of man, Sal. You love your whiskey and love your wife, but not necessarily in that order.
Also, late one afternoon, a stone artist from France came to our house and showed us the pictures of the famous Cliff Gardens restaurant that he'd built in Los Angeles.
How long will it take you to build us two water fountains? Asked my father.
Oh, maybe 2 or 3 months, said the stone artist, who told us to call him Frenchy.
I'll give you 2 weeks, said our dad.
Impossible, said Frenchy.
Why?
Well, just to get the material alone will take weeks.
Why?
Well, because up in Los Angeles we had to wait for this and then that, and it took weeks to get our supplies because of the war just ending.
No problema, said my dad. I have connections that no money can buy. You tell me what you need, and I'll have it here tomorrow.
The stone artist couldn't stop grinning. I like your style, he said to our dad. And so Frenchy moved in with us and worked day and night, eating Mexican food 3 times a day and drinking whiskey at night. And miracle of miracles, he completed 1 fountain in the front patio and another in the back patio in 3 weeks. But then there was another problema. Our mother wanted an elegant housewarming with fine dishes and crystal. But our father wanted a real kick-ass pachanga a lo ranchero with tortillas and everyone eating with their hands. After about a week of debating this issue, it was decided that, yes, champagne would be served in real crystal glasses, but also when the steer was taken out of the ground pit, the head and brains of the animal would be served with tortillas on a platter at the main table in puro tapatío de Jalisco Rancho Grande tradition. Parking the tractor in the tractor barn, I quickly ran between the fruit trees to our new home, and there was my father in the front patio, showing John Ford the layout of our new place. We still hadn't moved in all the way yet. We were still waiting for the rest of our furniture to arrive.
It's even more spectacular than I'd been told, Ford was telling my dad as I came running up. Is this fountain made of real stone? It's beautiful.
Absolutely, said my father. Everything is genuine real. In fact, there are 2 natural springs, one here in front and another one in the back. That's why my boss had his house built here, between the 2 springs.
This is a natural spring?
You got it,
said my dad with a grand smile. I almost laughed. These weren't natural springs. Hell, the water was piped in with copper pipes and the rocks were fake. But Frenchy, that great artist from France, had made the stones look so real, even though he'd made them out of cement, that it was hard to tell, especially with all the ferns and flowers planted around the little waterfall.
You want to go inside? Asked my father.
Oh, no, I've seen enough. I don't want to get you and your boy in trouble.
I told you the boss is gone right now. He wouldn't be back till late tonight. Come on in, and I'll show you around,
said my dad, opening the front door. The house was still mostly empty, and so our footsteps echoed throughout the large rooms.
Beautiful floors, said the man. All hardwood, clear oak, said my dad. Damn hard to get right now because it's so soon after the war.
Yes, I know. Some of my friends up in Los Angeles have been wanting to remodel their houses, but can't get the material.
Yeah. That's why it took my boss 2 years to build this house. But he's got big connections in high places, so he pulled strings to get what he needed.
I understand that he's called the Al Capone of the West, said the man.
My father glanced around, acting like he was suddenly real nervous.
Who told you that? Whispered my dad.
Well, I thought it was common knowledge that he'd been a bootlegger.
Shh, said my father. I didn't know that. But then, that explains why he always comes with a car full of armed bodyguards.
He does?
Yes,
said my father, still acting like he was nervous as hell.
I work for him 10 years, but I never ask him no questions. He treats me and my kid good, and that's all I need to know.
Maybe I better leave, said the man.
No, come in and see the bar. I'll fix you a drink.
I'm leaving,
said the man.
Look, I told you, he's not here right now. Come on down the hallway, and I'll fix us both a drink.
I watched my father take the man by the arm and walk him past the living room with the new carpet and spotless grand piano, past the dining room, by the kitchen, and to the playroom with the built-in bar. Outside of the playroom was the huge back patio for dancing. Next to it was the second fountain that was surrounded with even greater stonework and a profusion of palm trees and ferns.
My God, this is a paradise, said the man.
Yeah, pretty fancy, said my dad. What do you want? Scotch, tequila, whiskey?
Do you know if he has any of his old bootleg whiskey left? I hear tell he used to make the best liquor in the West.
That's what I've heard too, said my dad. Look, I think I know where he just might keep his last bottle of that stuff, but you got to promise to never tell a soul, or I could not just get fired, but, well, you know, if it ever got back to him, my son and I could disappear.
The man's eyes twisted.
Honestly? My God, I won't tell a soul, he said, licking his lips.
Okay, let me see. Yeah, here's the last bottle left, said my dad.
I had to bite my lip to not laugh as I watched my dad bring out his special old bottle and serve them each an inch of whiskey in a large glass. The man watched my father pour the golden liquid like it was pure gold, and I knew that this really wasn't even my dad's real bootleg whiskey. That he kept in the cellar under lock and key. What he was serving this man was Sunnybrook or Kentucky Cream or Canadian Club, which he said were almost as good as his own, and he kept one of these in an old bottle for an occasion just like this. Having poured the two whiskies, my dad handed the man one glass and took the other. The man sniffed his whiskey, held it up to see its color, nodded his approval. Then he sipped it like it was the greatest liquor he'd ever tasted.
Ah, that's good, he said. The best. But I better get out of here. I don't want to get you and your son in trouble. Come this weekend to the celebration, said my dad. Really? You think I could do that? Sure, why not? He's inviting the whole town. It will be a feast for kings. A whole barbecued steer, Mexican style, and music from across the border.
Okay, I'll come.
And here, he said, reaching into his pocket, for you and your son. He handed my father a $5 bill.
Thanks, said my father, pocketing the money. You don't know how much this means to me. Gracias.
Doesn't he pay you well?
Well, you know how rich people are. They didn't get rich by being generous.
Well, here, let me give you another.
No, no, this is enough. Thank you very mucho, said my father, continuing to act like he didn't know how to speak English very well. I'll walk you out to your car.
I watched my father walk the man out to his car and see him off. Then my dad came back into the house, laughing so hard that I thought he'd choke.
Lo chingue! Yelled my father.
And got paid for it, too. Oh, this is beautiful. And here, you get half of the $5, mijo, for not laughing. That was fun, eh?
But you lied about everything, Papa.
Yes, and he loved it.
My dad fixed himself another drink and laughed all the more. And when my mother came home with my brother and two sisters, they'd returned from San Diego. He told them the story, and my brother and sisters laughed. My mother didn't.
And what will you do if he comes, Salvador? You'll look like a fool, said our mother.
My father just winked.
No worry, querida. You just wait and see. Hell, he's a big movie producer from Hollywood, and he has a beach house down in Del Mar. Hell, he'll probably end up wanting to put me in the movies.
Early the next morning, we had to slaughter the steer. We'd already killed the two goats and the three pigs and taken the meat to Taloni's in Vista to keep the meat in his big walk-in cooler. Now all we had to do was the steer. For 2 months, we'd kept the steer penned up and we'd been grain-feeding him. Now he was over 1,000 pounds. Carefully, we got one rope over his horns and another rope on his left hind hoof. This way we could walk him from the corrals down the dirt road to our tractor barn, where we had the chain and pulley to hoist him up after we killed him. He wasn't a wild range animal anymore. We'd befriended him over the last 2 months while we'd been grain feeding him in the small fattening corral. He trusted us, and so we were able to walk him quietly from the corrals to the tractor barn. A couple of years back, George Lopez, a big, handsome family friend, had come roaring up on his Harley Davidson the day we were going to kill a steer, and the animal had spooked and taken off racing through the orchard. It had taken all the horsemanship that my father and my brother knew to get their ropes around two tree trunks and bring the bucking steer to a halt. Now, we had a truck parked at the fork in our road that came up towards the corrals so that nobody could come in on us. We were doing pretty well, and the big, young, juicy steer was almost inside the tractor barn, where we had a little grain and alfalfa waiting for him, when he abruptly stopped and began sniffing the ground. I glanced at my father. I guessed that the animal could smell where we'd killed and butchered the three pigs and two goats. But because of all the gas and oil of our farm equipment, we'd thought that he wouldn't smell the other animal's blood and guts. We were wrong. He was suddenly very wary. "Hold on to your ropes real good," said my father to my brother and our foreman. "It looks like he's gonna spook." Now the huge steer was snorting, and the hair had come up on his back.
"So what are we to do?"
asked my brother.
"I don't know," said our father. "But we got to keep calm so he don't smell any fear coming off of us."
All of our lives, our father had explained to us that there was a proper way to kill, that the animal had to be kept cool and calm, or the meat would have a funny little smell that wasn't good for our digestion. "That's why the meats from the big markets sometimes don't feel very good to us in the stomach," our dad explained to us, "because most slaughterhouses don't give a damn how they kill an animal. This is the reason Taloni's steaks are the sweetest in San Diego County. To kill with patience and understanding, even in war, is what my grandfather Don Pio, the greatest man who's ever lived, explained to us was necessary for any good leader." We all knew the story of our great-grandfather Don Pio very well. He'd been a short, dark Indian from Oaxaca, and he'd been the one who'd taught our father so much about respecting life. My brother had hold of the rope on the hind leg of the steer, and Nicolas, our top hand, had hold of the rope on the horns. My dad had his .22 Remington rifle in hand, and all the knives were inside of the bucket with which we were going to catch the blood. After all, fresh, warm blood was a real delicacy on a good, properly done kill.
"I guess we're going to have to get him out of here and maybe kill him under the pepper tree," said my dad. "But we got to move him real easy, so don't make any sudden movements."
"Couldn't we just get some gas on a rag and rub his nose with it, so he can't smell anything?" asked my brother.
"That might work, but also it could just confuse him, and confused animals, just like confused people, can get a little wild, mijito," said my father. "But what the hell, let's try it. Mundo, get some gas on a rag real pronto."
I quickly did as I was told. This animal was huge. We'd raised him since a calf. He was half Hereford and half Holstein. His face was all white, and his body was almost all black. I took the rag to our gas pump and rubbed it around the gas nozzle, then came back slowly towards the steer. If he panicked, he could really hurt me or tear up the place before they brought him under control.
"Relax yourself," said my father to me, seeing how scared I was. "If he smells any fear coming off you, we got trouble."
I took a big breath and blew out, trying my best to be fearless, but it was tough.
"Easy, big boy," I said to the huge animal. His head alone was bigger than me, and his horns had never been chopped and were long and razor sharp.
"This is just a rag with gas to confuse you," I said, "so we can kill you. Oops, no, I didn't mean that," I quickly added, not wanting to panic the animal, and yet I also didn't want to lie to him, figuring if I was truthful, he'd feel better. "Look, we want you to smell this rag to confuse you, so we can then..." Shit, Papa, what am I supposed to say to an animal that we're going to kill?
My brother Chava Boy and Nicolas burst out laughing.
Here, give me that damned rag, and you take the rifle and knives, said my father.
I gave my dad the rag, and he handed me his long barrel 22 Remington and the blood bucket with the knives.
Smell these, cabron, said my dad, putting the rag to the steer's nose.
The huge animal took one sniff of the rag and leaped about 3 feet straight into the air, whirling about, farting a huge alfalfa-smelling fart, and went racing out of the old tractor barn.
Hold him, shouted my dad. Work him over towards the pepper tree.
Digging his heels into the ground, Nicolas, a real vaquero from the state of Zacatecas, held the huge animal pretty well, and my brother was doing well too. But we could see that my brother was quickly tiring, so my father threw the rag away and took hold of the rope on the hind hoof with my brother, pulling and holding, then letting the animal go when he was pointed the right direction. We finally got the steer down to the big old pepper tree.
Tie him up, said my dad to Nicolas. Then go and get the hoist and chain from the tractor barn. This will give him time to calm down. And you, he said to me, go get the grain and alfalfa.
Nicolas and I quickly did as told. My father stayed behind with my brother and the steer. My brother wasn't looking so good. I quickly ran to get the grain and alfalfa and bring it back to the steer, while Nicolas climbed up in the rafters and got the tackle and chain off the main beam. Getting back to the pepper tree, I could see that my father looked pretty worried about my brother, and I could also see that my brother Joseph didn't want to be thought of as sick or weak, so he was holding on as strongly as he could. I had to fight back my tears. I loved my brother, and I could tell he was hurting. Finally, after about 20 minutes, the steer looked like he'd calmed down. He was starting to eat the grain and alfalfa and flick his tail to keep the flies off of himself. Talking gently to the big animal, my father now picked up his Remington and walked real carefully around the steer until he could get a clear shot at him between the eyes. And sure enough, one shot from that little 22 right between the eyes, just below the horns, and the huge beast went down like a ton of bricks, never knowing what had hit him. Instantly, expertly, my dad moved in with one of his knives and cut the steer's throat just under the jaw, slicing the jugular so that the blood would now quickly pump out of his body like nobody's business and into the blood bucket. The bucket was almost full when the huge animal began to kick his first kicks of death. Kicks so fast and wild and powerful that they actually yanked his whole body about and could have broken a grown man's leg if he wasn't well out of the way. Suddenly, all the cats and dogs on the ranch were at our side, attracted by the smell of the kill. But they didn't dare move in on us because they all knew that this kill belonged to us, the humans. Nicolas climbed up into the big pepper tree, got the short, thick chain over a stout limb, bolted the chain together, then hooked the chain and tackle to the short chain. As soon as the kicks of death had subsided, my dad moved in and cut slits in the steer's hind legs at the first main joint well above the hooves. Then he hooked each hind leg into the end of a wagon bar and started hoisting the steer up as we all began skinning him with our knives. We all knew what we were doing, so we had the huge animal skinned in less than 20 minutes. We moved a big wheelbarrow under him between his front legs, because we'd hoisted him ass up, and my dad gutted him, then went through the intestines looking for las tripas de leche that felt so warm and slippery to the hand. We also took the heart and liver, being very careful not to disturb the spleen or the piss bag. My mother would love the good job that we'd done. And she'd make blood pudding for us tonight, Mexican style, in a real tasty quesado with plenty of onions and garlic. I could hardly wait. That same afternoon, we dug a huge pit and lined the bottom with rocks. Then that night, right after midnight, we started a huge fire with lots of good, solid wood that would take a long time in burning. This night, I got to sleep outside with the vaqueros while they played guitars, drank tequila, watched the fire, and told stories of the old days when hombres were hombres a todo dar, and they'd been doing this kind of killing and preparation since the beginning of time all over the whole world. An hour before daybreak, my father came to check on the fire, which was now mostly coals. Then he and Nicolas and a couple of other men went to the old ranch house with the huge kitchen, where the women had been soaking the different meats all night in herbs and spices. My father and the men wheelbarrowed the meat of the steer and the two goats to the pit. Each piece of meat was wrapped in clean white sheets, and then wrapped in wet burlap and tied into bundles with good solid cotton cord. The three pigs we would cook above ground in a great big copper kettle on an open fire to make chicharrones. We now lowered each of the huge bundles of meat into the burning hot pit with shovels and pitchforks. A couple bundles of corn and squash and sweet potatoes were put into the pit, too. Then iron pipes were placed across the pit, and sheets of corrugated metal were laid crosswise over the pipes. The men told me that in the old days in Mexico, they'd used green logs instead of iron pipes, and palm or banana leaves instead of metal sheets. Either way, it didn't matter, they'd explained to me. What was important was to build a support so that the pit could then be covered with about 5 inches of dirt to hold in the heat. Every inch of the metal sheets was now carefully covered with dirt until not one little spirally pinch of smoke escaped. Then it was done, and we now had ourselves an earthen oven, a way that people had been cooking, my dad told me, for millions of years all over the Mother Earth. The father sun was just rising on the distant horizon above the treetops in beautiful colors of orange and red and gold when we finished. My father and the men passed around the last of the bottle of tequila and the jar of blood that had been especially prepared with lemon and spices.
"Now everyone get some shut-eye," said my dad. "Then we'll have huevos ranchos in a couple of hours, then get the rest of this feast ready. And remember, our guests will start getting here around noon, and I don't want to see one of you cabrones drunk. This celebration is to last 3 days and nights, and we got to show these gringos that we, los Mexicanos, can have a celebration a lo chingón without getting drunk and ending up in a damn fight. Okay?"
The ranch hands all agreed, and I went home to our new house with my dad. My whole head was full of all the different smells that I'd been experiencing in the last 2 days. All the animals slaughtered, all the innards separated, and all the food that was being prepared. Tortillas, frijoles, tripas de leche, chicharrones, and that special combination of apple cobbler and capirotada. Smell was so important, and hearing was too. The singing of the men around the huge fire was still ringing in my ears. I went up the stairs of our new house and lay down in the room that I shared with my brother, but I couldn't sleep. I was so excited. My brother was down the hallway in our new bathroom, and I could hear him coughing. For months now, my parents kept taking my brother to our local doctor, who lived up the hill from us on California Street and had horses. But Dr. Hoskins kept saying that nothing was wrong with my brother, that he was just going through growing pains, and this was why he was always tired and not feeling well. When I awoke, I could hear people's loud, happy voices downstairs, and I could see that my brother was lying down on his bed across the room from me, and he was wide awake, but he didn't look so good. "What is it, Jose?" I asked.
"I don't know," he said. I could see that he'd been crying.
"Do you want me to go and get Mama?" I asked.
"No, I think I'll just stay up here and rest so Papa and Mama can have their celebration without worrying about me. You see, Mundo," he added, as he kept staring up at the ceiling, "Papa and Mama have worked so hard for this day that I don't want to ruin it for them." I nodded. My brother Joseph, he was always so smart and good-hearted.
I wasn't like him at all. I'd be yelling at the top of my lungs for Mama if I didn't feel well, not giving a damn,
I mean blessed,